Close your eyes and imagine a blind street musician capable of creating an utterly unique fusion of classical, traditional and vernacular American musics. Now imagine that he numbered both Charlie Parker and Igor Stravinsky amongst his admirers, had one of his songs recorded by Janis Joplin, survived a surreal collaboration with Julie Andrews, and exerted a crucial influence on Philip Glass, Steve Reich and John Zorn. OK, now forget the imaginary bit, because this guy actually existed. His name was Lewis Thomas Hardin, but he was better known simply as Moondog. Lewis Hardin was born in Marysville, Kansas, on May 26, 1916. His father was an itinerant Episcopalian minister, but an unorthodox one, establishing the dissident family tradition into which the man who would become Moondog was born.
My father became a missionary, and he wrote a controversial book when he was in Wisconsin, and it was very critical of the church hierarchy, and the bishop said, well, we can't have you stay here. We'll send you out to the cowboys and the Indians. In other words, we send you to Siberia. So that's how we got to go to Wyoming.
In the course of his missionary work, Hardin Sr. inadvertently provided his son with his most profound childhood experience.
When I was about six, my father went to this Indian reservation in Wyoming, the Arapaho Reservation, and I heard the Sundance ceremony. And Chief Yellow Cap let me sit in his lap, and he gave me a drumstick, and I beat on the big tom-tom. It's a pom 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 pom. It's a running beat, and then the walking beat, one, two, one, two. I was amazed when I heard them play against that steady drum beat, that heartbeat. They're always offbeat, they're always syncopating. And I said, my God, this sounds like jazz. And it is. It's a fundamental. It's much older than we think. Jazz syncopation is as old as the Indians. And that goes back thousands of years, so it's not new at all.
Well, perhaps the Africans had something to do with jazz as well. But it doesn't matter which train you ride as long as it gets you there on time. And in Moondog's case, it did. Albeit through one of the weirdest routes in 20th century American music. At the age of 16, Lewis Hardin was blinded when a railway dynamite cap exploded in his face. Attending Iowa School for the Blind, he received his first formal musical tuition, studying theory and learning keyboards and the violin family. His obvious aptitude for music was soon recognised, and he went on to receive personal tuition from the head of the Memphis Conservatory. It was here, as his passion for music grew, that he became involved in his own singular musical dialectic, extracting what he needed from European and African forms to create his own uniquely American synthesis.
I came to New York in 1943. That's the first time I left my family. I was about 27 then. I didn't know anybody in New York, and It was very difficult in the beginning. I had to pose in art schools to make enough to pay for my rent and food.
It required considerable courage for Lewis to move to New York City with no obvious means of support, but he was driven by the dream of becoming a composer. That same dream led him to the stage door of Manhattan's most famous venue, Carnegie Hall, where he talked with, and greatly impressed, Artur Rodzinski. In fact, Rodzinski was so impressed that he offered Hardin an extraordinary privilege.
He was conducting the Philharmonic at that time, and he let me go to all rehearsals. And I learned a lot about orchestration from being at the rehearsals.
Significant as his time at the New York Phil must have been for Hardin's musical education, it was his brusque eviction from rehearsals in 1947 that had the most lasting impact on him. The army blanket tunics he was wearing apparently offended the refined aesthetic sensibilities of some of those involved with the orchestra. He was told to dress conventionally or leave. The experience wounded Lewis Hardin greatly, but it also radicalized him.
I got disillusioned with New York, and I went out west in 1948, and planning never to come back. But by the next year, by 49, I was back in New York again and started playing drums in the doorways. I was developing a new kind of rhythm. I call it snake time. It's 5-4 time, 5-8, 5-2, and also in sevens, 7-2, and 7-4. So these were offbeat rhythms, and I was playing them on my little drums that I had built for me, and playing directly to the people. And within a few weeks, I got a notice in Walter Winchell's column. And then a few months later, in 1950, I got a chance to do some 78 singles with my drums.
Before long, Moondog, as he had now christened himself, had become a Manhattan micro-celebrity. Some of the biggest names in music, such as Charlie Parker and Benny Goodman, would stop and chat. Parker even suggested they should record together. In the event, though, it was Gabriel Oller, proprietor of the Spanish Music Center, in whose doorway Moondog had been performing, who commissioned his first recordings. One of these, Moondog Symphony, became the theme tune for the pioneering rhythm and blues show hosted by disc jockey Alan Freed. Unfortunately, Freed borrowed not only the tune, but the composer's sobriquet, calling himself Moondog.
Hello, everybody. How are y'all tonight? This is Alan Freed, the old king of the Moondoggers, and it's time again for another of your favorite rock and roll sessions, blues and rhythm records for all the gang in the Moondog Kingdom from the Midwest to the East Coast. Enjoy the Moondog Show!
Lewis Hardin sued Freed and won. Legend has it that Stravinsky himself intervened with the judge to endorse Hardin as a legitimate musician and composer.
Thank you.
In the mid-50s, thanks to his 78s and the publicity surrounding the Freed case, Moondog was given the opportunity to cut three albums for the prominent jazz label Prestige Records. The range and originality of the music he produced is staggering. String ensembles, crying babies, sax sections, barking dogs and croaking frogs, poems and vocal rounds set to percussion, all combined through imaginative use of lo-fi overdubbing. And did I mention the tiger growling and the tap dancer? The albums also featured Moondog not only playing on the street, but with it, juxtaposing his musical and spoken word performances with the ambient sounds of the city.
I'll try another one.
All right, here you go, Tony.
All right.
Sure.
Prestige albums, which stand today as three of his most important works, were followed by Moondog's most incongruous and surreal collaboration. The neo-traditional avant-gardist was invited to compose and arrange musical settings of the Mother Goose children's stories for no less a personage than Julie Andrews.
Tell it again, tell it again, tell it just the same. The very same people, the very same story, and call it the very same name. Tell it again.
By the 1960s, Moondog, now in his second decade as a street performer, had jettisoned his army blankets in favour of slightly more colourful apparel.
I think there must have been something in the atmosphere, some kind of a spirit of rebellion, desire for a new start. I felt very rebellious. I was even changing my style of dress at that time, different clothing. I'd made my own outfits.
One of those who encountered this living Manhattan landmark was future composer John Zorn.
It was in December. It was snowing. I must have been out with my parents because I think I was like 13. So it must have been the mid-60s sometime. And we were walking down the street and I saw this guy in a Viking outfit. He got the hat and holding a spear and a whole outfit, big beard. I said, "Who is that?" And my father said, "Well, that's Moondog." I said, what is going on with this guy? And he was selling his own music that he had privately printed in little booklets for like 50 cents. And there was like a horn around his neck that you could put money into. And then there was a little leather pouch that had these little pamphlets. So I told my father I wanted to get some of that music. And he said, "Well, you go and put 50 cents in the horn." I was kind of afraid to do it. And I went over and I put some money in the horn, and he said thank you. And I took a Moondog Madrigal. I took it home, and it was like kind of folk music, you know, with lyrics and what have you. And what struck me was just, you know, here was a guy who was doing it all on his own. He printed his own music, he stood there and he sold it. And he kind of had a reputation, he had an image, and that was my first encounter.
Trees against the sky, fields of plenty, rivers to the sea. Lifts and more spreads before me. Trees against the sky, fields of plenty, trees against the sky.
The times, they were a-changing pretty quickly in New York City. Apart from anything else, the number of eccentrically dressed individuals was rising exponentially. Soaking it all up was a young, soon-to-be musician, Paddy Paladin.
Dylan was happening and still very, you know, very potent, very important. You had Hendrix playing the Café Wa. The overspill of that would have gone into things like Zappa, let's say. On the other side of the coin, you would have Yoko Ono making a statement by having a storefront that she hired out for people to crash on an hourly basis in sleeping bags and calling it an art statement. You had Smokin's in Tompkins Square Park, where the Fugs would be playing and the Jefferson Airplane would come in. And in the middle of all this going on, like some kind of acid vision of a Buckingham Palace god, is Moondog standing stoically on the corner of 54th and 6th. And he was there day and night, like some kind of foundation for it all. He was almost some kind of anchor, talking to, I suppose, whoever would engage him in conversation. He was this fabulous freak dressed as a Viking.
Around this time, a song fragment from the Prestige era came to the attention of Big Brother and the Holding Company, a rough-hewn San Francisco rock band featuring vocalist Janis Joplin.
Oh, is loneliness here for me? Loneliness here for me? Loneliness.
As Paddy Paladin recalls, the degrees of separation between Joplin and Moondog were considerably fewer than six.
I was at a Janis gig at the Fillmore East, and I remember her coming up to the front of the stage and saying, "Oh, I'd like to point out a very special guest who's in the audience tonight, who was kind of sitting in my row." And floodlights started to scan the audience. And boom, it was Benny Goodman.
Mm-hmm.
The diverse, eclectic spirit of the late 60s provided an opening for the veteran street maverick, courtesy of producer James William Guercio, a classically trained rocker who'd worked with Frank Zappa in the early days of the Mothers of Invention. Guercio's records with Chicago and Blood, Sweat and Tears earned millions for Columbia Records. The producer assembled a regiment of musicians to cut Moondog's first full-on symphonic recording.
Records came out on Columbia, maybe 1969, 1970. I must have been like 16, 17 by then. And I went to him to ask him which record I should get. There was a chamber one and there was a symphonic one. And so I said, these two records came out on Columbia, Moondog. Which one should I get? And he said, well, the orchestral one is heavy. I'll never forget that. So I went and I bought the orchestral one.
The album included Moondog's tributes to Charlie Parker and Benny Goodman, as well as a ballet piece commissioned by the Martha Graham Company, but never performed. A subsequent Columbia album of Cannons and Madrigals, cut on a significantly lower budget with a small group including Moondog's daughter, was far less noteworthy, effectively severing the Columbia connection. Then, in 1974, Moondog vanished from the streets of Manhattan. Some thought that he was dead. In fact, he'd been invited to Germany.
Well, an organist friend of mine made a contact with a German radio station called the Hessischer Rundfunk, and they wanted me to do a concert of my music, so I came over and conducted a small orchestra of my music, and I liked it so much here I didn't go back to America.
Performing on the streets of Recklinghausen, a small town near Cologne, he was approached by a woman named Ilona Goebel, who subsequently became his patron. She invited him to live with her family, serving as manager, assistant and publisher for the next quarter century. She even persuaded him to ditch the Viking gear.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of the number of discs released, Moondog's 25 years in Germany were just as productive as the 3 decades he spent on the streets of New York. And as you can hear, there are moments of great beauty on the later recordings, but as with many artists and composers, it is his early work that leaves the most powerful impression. It is ironic that at the time of his death in 1999, this blind man obsessed with sound was probably still better known for the way he'd looked 25 years earlier than for his music. For many of his fellow artists, however, the true importance of the Viking of Sixth Avenue was far more significant. John Zorn.
Very concrete, his effect in terms of his independent stance on him and Parch and Ives and, you know, the American Mavericks, the ones who did it on their own without support, who were misunderstood for many, many years, are very much an inspiration. What he was doing was very connected to what's happening now in terms of the way he put different kinds of music together without any kind of hierarchical sense of it. He took what he liked and he made music with it, whether it was animal sounds, folk music, classical, noise, whatever he heard that he was interested in and cared about, respected, became part of his world.